You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kia ora te whanau, you are on the BFM Breakfast Show. This is Stinky Jim with Frying Cymbals, and we're going to be having a chat to Jim himself on the other side of this about the brand new record. It's not what it sounds like, so stick around. That is Stinky Jim with Frying Cymbals. Kia ora, Jim. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, Rachel. Kia ora to you and BFM listeners.
It's very nice to be able to chat to you. We're missing all the BFM whānau at the moment, and this is a very exciting new record that you've put out in the world. How are you feeling about it?
I'm well, blown away, actually. I've sort of been humbled by the support I've had for it. It's been incredible. And it's a strange thing, because these weren't songs that were written necessarily for release. They were written for cathartic pleasure and seeing how long the piece of string goes. And and so for them to end up being released is a thing in itself, and then for people to end up enjoying them is a whole other world. And it's been great.
How do you go about writing a track, Jim? What do you work on? Is it a program on a computer, or are you a hardware kind of a guy? What's your process?
Well, I have a few different ones. I use Native Instruments Machine as my sort of weapon of choice, which is, you know, like an MPC or similar to that kind of thing, I guess. And I use Ableton as well. But I also have a large amount of Foolish Toys, which I'm obsessed with, which I try to incorporate as well. So I try to sort of... I mean, a lot of it is done in the box, as they say, but I try to make sure that there are outside elements in there, because I do think it really affects the feel of the whole thing.
Mm.
So it's a right old mess, really.
That's the best way to make, isn't it? Just sort of a bit of everything thrown into the pot. I'm interested in this idea of how long is the piece of string. What piece of string are you chasing? Do you just sort of get a feeling or a sense for something that you want to work into a track, and then you just kind of run down that road? Or do you sort of sit down with a specific plan in mind?
Well, it sort of varies. I mean, I basically pretty much... work on music every day. You know, that's my downtime or whatever, I guess. And sometimes I go into things with a specific thing in mind, like for example, Stunted Orbis, the last track on the album, that I started writing that the night that David Bowie died.
Oh,
and
wow.
That started as a completely ambient piece, and it was all pads, there was no beats or anything like that, and it was just about how I was feeling, which was devastated, but I wanted to do something more constructive than being devastated. And then it turned into something completely different. And it, you know, as I say, it started off sort of as an ambient piece, God help us, and and then it ended up being something completely different. So that there's a lot of that goes on, where I might start off with something in mind, like Flying Cymbals is based on Bunny Lee and King Tubby's Flying Cymbal sounds, which was a big thing in Jamaica in the 70s, and I wrote a whole sort of EP of tunes based on that. And out of the four tunes, there was one that I thought was really worthwhile, and that's the one that ended up being on the album. So sometimes there's a very specific thing in mind, and often it's just me farting around and seeing what comes out, and then, oh, hang on, that's quite interesting, and off you go.
So some of these ideas have obviously been on the burner for quite some time, if we're looking all the way back to when Bowie died. How did you know a track was ready to be released, or did you even think about it being something you'd put out?
No, not at all. I've none of these songs were written with release in mind at all, and it's really just a set of fortuitous circumstances that's meant that they were released. Which first up, a couple of people played my tunes on the radio overseas, sort of like Andrew Weatherall and Steve Barker on BBC Radio Lancashire and stuff like that, just because they liked them. And And that was a huge confidence boost. Then last year, when we were going through lockdown, my long-suffering wife, said, look, you know, she kept on going, why aren't you releasing that? And I'd be like, oh, well, I'm not happy with the bass yet, or blah, 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 all this nannery stuff. And she just gave me the proverbial boot up the pants and said, you know, sort it out. With the Bandcamp Fridays thing, it became an excellent way of getting something out every month. So I was doing that, producing those songs by myself, not with anybody else involved whatsoever. And through the process of doing that, I sort of ended up looking and going, oh my God, I've got over 200 songs here that haven't been released. This is getting a bit silly. And so I picked out a bunch that I thought made a kind of strange sense in my head, and then took them down to Angus McNaughton down in Dunedin out on the peninsula, and mixed and mastered them down there with him. And hey presto, that was an album.
That's fantastic. And it seems like I think a lot of people have experienced, especially in the last year, weird good things to come out of the pandemic, like Bandcamp Friday. It's been one of those things where it's been a really like a focal point for music communities all around the world to say, actually, yeah, we want to support what artists are doing. And in some ways it's been a way for artists to have an excuse or a reason to put out a track that maybe they'd had on the burner for a while and hadn't thought about releasing. I know you're a man with very strong opinions about the way that music, the music sort of selling business and buying of music business is working at the moment. How are you feeling about the way Bandcamp Friday is changing or accelerating the game at the moment?
Well, I mean, it was actually a sort of a building block in the making of the album. If Bandcamp Fridays hadn't happened, this record would never have come out. And I am releasing the album strictly on Bandcamp. There'll be a few digital retailers later on, your Beatports and Junos and stuff like that, because you need to do that. But it's not going to be available on Spotify. It's not going to be available on YouTube. If people want to stream it, they can forget about it because it's not going to happen. I'm not doing this for money or fame or anything else. I'm doing this because I love making music and I love tunes, and again, seeing where the ball of string ends up. And so I don't see any reason to denigrate and cheapen what I've done by putting it on Spotify and making it an object of convenience that you get ripped off on. So Bandcamp is, to me, tremendously important, because it's for someone who makes music and buys music, and we've just gone through a Bandcamp Friday. I put my album out. I then went and spent over $100 the next day on amazing tunes. You know, next Tuesday's Stinky Grooves is going to be so rammed with good tunes. And so Bandcamp, you know, this is a wonderful thing where a platform has actually become a constructive part of the process instead of a negative parasitical part of the process.
Yeah.
So I doff my cap to Bandcamp big time.
If anybody is wondering what Bandcamp Friday is, it's basically once a month, I think they're doing it now, where they get rid of all of the fees that they take, the percentages that they would take, which are actually quite low anyway.
15%, yeah.
Yeah, which compared to a lot of other platforms is not much, but it's pretty much all the money goes directly to the artist. So it's a pretty good time to spend some cash on things that maybe you've had on your watch list for a while. I've certainly found it's been lovely to just go on Bandcamp Friday and watch the ticker of all the stuff that's been sold. It's my new favourite lockdown hobby, is just watching it all fly past and think, yeah, that's good. Everyone's getting behind the music that they love at the moment. I wanted to know a little bit, if you had to sort of like say there was any kind of theme or through line or idea to this record, Jim, is there some sort of thing that draws all of these tracks together on It's Not What It Sounds Like?
Well, beyond my involvement, yes and no. I mean, there is a narrative. There's an arc to it. In as much as, you know, the first couple of tracks, I guess, are sort of referring to what I've done in the past with Unitone Hi-Fi and what have you, in the more sort of dubby vein. The next two or three tracks are definitely very much about my love of CR78 drum machines, library music, stand-up bass, things like Young Hole Trio and stuff like that. And then it goes into a whole sort of I like to think of it as a sort of a sub-aqua kind of slowed down, moody, dubbed out thing, but that's quite different to the first couple of tracks, which are much more orthodox. And then it ends up with this sort of bizarre obsession with the flying cymbals and stuff like that. So there is a narrative arc, but not necessarily one that you can say track 8 relates to track 1 or whatever.
Well, we're going to play the track Hamlet Momentito now. What can you tell us about this one? What was going on when you were writing this?
The title, and older English people will know this, is from in the 70s there was these ads for Hamlet cigars, which were these crappy cigars, really cheap bog standard cigars, and they had these ads which had this piece of music which was a famous piece of classical music which I can't think off the top of my head, but they would play this and something would go disastrously wrong, and they're actually worth looking up on YouTube, the Hamlet cigar ads, because they're great. Something would go horrifically wrong and then this music would play, and the person would be sitting there with a cigar, as you could do in the 70s, and this music would be playing, and they'd be having this sort of like this moment of peace after their hair's been set on fire or something like that. So that's what the title's about. And musically, it's about my love of Martin Denny, the exotica producer, who I absolutely adore, and there is a sneaky Martin Denny sample in there. And also, it sort of also refers to, as I mentioned before, Young Holt Trio, who are Ramsey Lewis's backing band, who I've been quite obsessed with for a number of decades. And, you know, they're sort of, they did the ultimate version of In With The In Crowd and stuff like that. And it's that kind of just my take on that, I guess you could say.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us, Jim. It's always a pleasure. And if people want to go and get this record, then Bandcamp is the place to go. It's Not What It Sounds Like, a digital album, and it's 10 tracks and sits at 50 minutes. It's a strong, strong record. Thank you for speaking
with
us about it, Jim.
Thanks a lot.
We'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care. We'll be right back.
95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.